Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, our Financial Services Practice Group is hosting a panel debate on systemic risk regulators. We will be joined by Wayne Abernathy, Peter Wallison, and our moderator, John Douglas. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. And now, let's hand it over to our moderator for the day, Mr. Douglas.
This is John Douglas. I'm chair of the Financial Services Committee of the Federalist Society, and I want to welcome you to our podcast discussion, nominally entitled a debate, but what is more likely to be a conversation, between Peter Wallison and Wayne Abernathy discussing systemic risk regulators. I want to welcome Peter to us. Peter is... holds the Arthur F. Burns Chair in Financial Policy Studies and is co-director of the American Enterprise Institute's Program on Financial Markets Deregulation. Previously, he was a partner at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher in Washington, and prior to that held a number of senior government positions, including General Counsel of the Treasury and White House Counsel to President Reagan. In both capacities, he worked substantially on financial services issues, including deregulation of the financial services industry. I'm joined by Wayne Abernathy. Wayne is with the American Bankers Association, which he joined in February of 2005, in the position of Executive Director for Financial Institutions Policy and Regulatory Affairs. He oversees the ABA groups that deal with policy development, regulatory issues, bank general counsels, economics, tax, and accounting. He spent more than 20 years in financial policymaking. Prior to joining the ABA, he was Treasury Assistant Secretary for Financial Institutions under President George W. Bush, and previously served as Republican Staff Director of the United States Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs, where he also served as Committee Staff Director to Chairman Phil Graham. I want to welcome both Peter and Wayne. And to start, I guess I should point out that the nominal title of this is Systemic Risk Regulators. And Peter, I'd like to ask you if you wouldn't sort of address this issue for us in terms of where Washington is and whether this is a real problem that needs a solution.
Yeah, John, thanks very much. I would like to talk about systemic regulators and the whole idea of systemic regulation, because this is the administration's program. Secretary Geithner, late in March, was up before the House Financial Services Committee and outlined what I thought was an extraordinarily radical, if I can use that word, idea for the regulation of the financial system in the future, starting with what he called a systemic regulator. The idea of a systemic regulator is a regulatory agency of some kind that would look over the entire economy and decide whether systemic risks are developing in that economy and presumably then in some way suppress them. In addition, and this is where it starts to get much more troublesome to me, is the idea that this systemic regulator would then have the right, the authority, to designate systemically important firms in every one of the financial industries. In other words, securities, among securities firms, insurance companies, hedge funds, finance companies, any organization that participates in the financial world could be designated as systemically significant. Now, what does it mean to be so designated? And as far as I can tell, what it means is that you are regulated in a special way. But more important than anything else is the fact that once you have been designated as systemically significant, in effect, the government has said you will not be allowed to fail. Because what it means to be systemically significant is that your failure could stimulate some kind of systemic breakdown. So when a company is designated as systemically significant, it is in effect, for the first time that I am aware of, it is in effect a certification by the government that you will not be allowed to fail. And that is very, very important from a competitive point of view, because I think it allows those firms that are designated that way to present themselves to the market as less risky than their smaller competitors. And because they're less risky, they could probably raise funds at a lower rate and ultimately outcompete their smaller competitors. Now, if that sounds familiar to someone, it's because we've had that already. We've had two companies like that. They were called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And what made them such powerful competitors was that the market simply did not believe that they would be allowed to fail. And as a result, it was much easier for them to raise money and raise money at lower cost. And that's precisely, it seems to me, what the government is doing here. They are reinventing Fannie Mae's and Freddie Mac's throughout the financial system if they are successful in getting this power. There's more, and we can talk about it further in this conversation, but just let me mention that I think it's an important subject, and that is the ability of the government or the authority in the government to resolve these financial institutions, that is to either rescue them or liquidate them outside the bankruptcy law in much the way that the FDIC now has power to resolve banks. So that also strikes me as a very troubling thing, but we can talk about that in a little while.
Wayne, do you have any sort of initial thoughts about this?
Yeah, I do, and thank you very much for inviting me to be on the call. I guess the first point that I'd have to make is I think I agree with just about everything that Peter just said. There is a level of systemic risk, I think, that's undeniable, but I think if you trace it back, in most cases, if not in every case, there's some kind of government agency or some kind of government policy that lies behind that systemic risk, making it possible, either facilitating the concentration or eliminating competitive alternatives or otherwise creating some kind of government franchise. And I think the example of Fannie and Freddie are probably the best examples of that. They were created as government-sponsored enterprises with a whole bunch of protections around them that muted market discipline and allowed them to become systemically significant entities. And because they had become systemically significant, you needed to have some means of resolving those institutions should an impending failure arrive. And fortunately, legislation was enacted almost a matter of a few weeks before it was needed to be exercised to deal with the meltdown of Fannie and Freddie. I think many would say that that kind of legislation was long delayed because maybe it could have prevented the arrival of the problems that finally brought Fannie and Freddie to the point where a systemic risk regulatory program was needed to be put in place. But I think probably a place to start when you're talking about systemic risk is asking what is it that causes that systemic risk? What is its source? And once you identify that, then I think you can deal with the proper response to it. And if we're not careful in trying to pre-position some kind of authorities, we can end up creating a whole lot of these problems in place, like we did with Fannie and Freddie and like we might have done with other institutions.
You know, that's a really good point. And the thing that I think puzzles me more than anything else about this entire debate is not so much what the administration has proposed about systemically significant companies, but why they believe that regulation is the answer. Because if we look at the banking system, which has been heavily regulated for well, certainly for my lifetime, but very heavily regulated. As you know, John, since 1991, when FIDICIA was passed after the last market breakdown in the depository institution area, FIDICIA was a very, very tough new law, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation Improvement Act, and it was supposed to end bank crises for all time because it was so tough. And, of course, now, 17 years later, we are in the midst of probably the worst banking crisis of all time. So what has happened here is, without any debate, the notion has developed that somehow we are going to be able to prevent systemic risk if we regulate all these institutions. And one can argue that, at least with respect to the banking industry, the Federal Reserve has been a systemic regulator all along. The Fed has had the power to regulate the holding companies of all of the major banks in the United States and look at the condition of the banking industry after years and years of Fed systemic regulation.
This is Wayne speaking again. I would add to that that I think if we were looking just at the banking sector, by banking I'm talking about institutions that take deposits and make loans that have an FDIC insurance guarantee behind them, there has been a systemic risk program in place for all parts of that industry. And if that is all that we were looking at, even if the very largest of those banking institutions were to be in a situation of impending failure, the elements and pieces are all there to deal with that. Even years ago, not too many years ago, but while Chairman Greenspan was chairman of the Federal Reserve, he pointed out in congressional testimony, in his view, there was no institution that was too big to fail. The issue was just having the right program to deal with the failure of any particular institution. Unfortunately, I don't think the market fully believed that, and I think there was a need probably to make that more credible. And I think as we saw under the current financial crisis we're in, various institutions that were called banks but weren't banks, and I'm thinking of a Bear Stearns and a Lehman and an AIG, as they, in essence, melted down, they were confused as if they were banks, and there were no systems in place for an orderly unwinding of some of these institutions, that you ended up getting the banking industry tarnished reputationally by the lack of having a systemic resolution program in place for those institutions, which created the mindset on the part of many people in the country that there must not be one for the banks either, when in fact there was one and there continues to be one in place for the banking industry.
Yeah, Wayne, that's right. Actually, I want to advance this proposition, and that is that it is only a bank that could, in theory, create systemic risk. I don't believe that any non-banking institution like a hedge fund or an insurance company or a finance company or a securities firm can create systemic risk. And the reason is simple, and that is that banks have deposits that are withdrawable on demand. Those deposits are essentially part of our money supply. People rely on those deposits to make payroll and to meet ordinary daily expenses. And if a bank fails, and we're talking here about a very large bank, it might not be able to make payments to not only to its own customers but to other banks. And that can cascade, this is the theory, that can cascade through the rest of our economy and cause what might be thought of as a systemic breakdown. But when you're talking about a securities firm or you're talking about an insurance company or some other kind of institution, most of their liabilities are term liabilities. People are not relying on them for the cash that they need for day-to-day activities. And it is much, much more difficult for there to be runs on those kinds of institutions than on banks. So I would actually draw the line at any sort of resolution process and say it is only for banks that we need a resolution process. And if we try to extend that resolution process to other kinds of financial institutions, what we will essentially do is create a system for the regulators, who are always willing to do this, to bail out organizations that don't need to be bailed out and could go through the bankruptcy process. That in itself will create moral hazard and hence more risk-taking and make other sectors of the economy very shaky over time.
This is Wayne Abernathy speaking. I think that we have in place a very good program for the resolution of any bank of any particular size, or even a collection of various banks. And it has been tried from time to time. In recent memory, in the recent couple of years, as well as not many years ago when we had in the late 80s hundreds of banks that had failed. I remember working for Senator Phil Graham of Texas, and every Friday or Thursday afternoon I'd get a phone call, and they'd give me the names of the three or four or five banks that had failed that particular week. And in Texas, you had 9 of the 10 largest banks fail or have to be merged through an assistant merger process. But I'm not sure that I could agree that there are no institutions outside of the banking sector that don't pose what could be called a systemic risk. And I think like an elephant is the kind of thing that that's difficult to describe ahead of time, but you will know it when you see it. And I think we need to differentiate between something that might cause a technical series of events that could result in some systemic breakdown and a collapse of a financial institution that could create that probably all too serious but fortunately uncommon event of a financial panic. I was looking at a speech that was given, I think, just yesterday or the day before by Governor Warsh of the Federal Reserve, and for the first time I saw one of the Federal Reserve Board governors correctly identify that what we saw in 2008 was a good old-fashioned financial panic. And I think a financial panic can, particularly on a large scale, have systemic implications. And I'm not sure that that would be limited to banks. And in fact, I don't think you're likely to get a panic anymore from the failure of a banking institution because there is in place a well-recognized system to provide for the orderly wind down of those operations. But I don't think this is well recognized a system in place for some non-bank institutions. Now, I think as we consider that, we have to admit that it would be rare. I don't think you need to identify institutions ahead of time because it may not be any one particular institution. It may be a certain type of impending failure in certain types of market conditions that caused the problem. I think that was really the story with regard to Bear Stearns about a year ago. Now, without defending whether that should have been done or not, I think the perception was on the part of Treasury and the Federal Reserve was that given the market conditions at the time, the Bear failure could have caused a financial panic. Again, that's without trying to justify what was done there. But I could imagine several institutions, I think, for example, important clearing institutions, that were they to cease their function, you could cause a very significant panic that would have systemic implications.
That's a good point. This is Peter Wallison. But I do want to say that you have raised exactly the right circumstances in which it would make sense to have some kind of resolution system in place for non-bank institutions, and that is in the case of a financial panic. And what you have to think about then is how often a financial panic of the kind we have experienced in the last 2 years, year and a half, has actually occurred. It is exceedingly rare. And there hasn't been one other than this one in the last couple of years in my lifetime, and I don't even think there was anything on a worldwide basis during the Great Depression in the 30s era. So the point is, if we are going to be making public policy here, should we make public policy in the form of a huge resolution system and a new regulatory system for all of the financial world on the basis of a financial panic that has happened only once in anyone's experience and set up a regulatory structure and a resolution structure that would achieve that, achieve some sort of control over that process with all of the downsides that will come from such a regulatory structure? And when I talk about downsides, I'm saying that everyone has understood for a long time that when regulation occurs, it raises costs, it reduces or suppresses innovation, it reduces competition. All of the things that we want to avoid are the result of regulation, and we tolerate regulation in areas where it occurs because there isn't any alternative. In the banking area, there's certainly no alternative because banks are backed, at least a substantial portion of their deposits are backed by the government. So you must have regulation in order to avoid the problem that you've created with market discipline, you've introduced moral hazard into the banking business. But outside the banking business, for organizations that are not regulated by the government, such as securities firms and hedge funds and private equity and finance companies and so forth, to institute regulation in the very, very rare case where there might be sometime in the future another financial panic doesn't seem to me to be good policy.
I would like to propose that we divide this subject into two pieces, because I think what I'm hearing is pretty strong agreement that the idea of having identification of systemically significant institutions is a very, very bad idea. And along with that would go all of the apparatus for a regulatory program to regulate these systemically significant institutions once found. And I see that as the most troubling element in some of the proposals that are floated around, that you would have these institutions, you would identify what they are, and then you just, as I think Peter correctly pointed out, you end up creating a whole bunch of government, if not government-sponsored enterprises, with what I call government-franchised enterprises, enterprises that are created by the private sector but now enjoy very significant government franchise benefits. And I think you don't want to do that for a whole host of reasons. Separating that out, I still see a value in having some kind of systemic resolution authority. I agree that the opportunities for panic have been rare. I hope they stay that way. I don't want to predict that they'll stay that way, though. I think a lot of the things that happened to bring about the most recent panic are not necessarily once-in-a-lifetime events. I think these are events that could occur again, and so you could have a systemic situation where you need to have a resolution authority in place that is better than the very cumbersome bankruptcy laws. And what I have in mind is really something along the lines of bankruptcy, but some entity that has authority to resolve problems, resolve all the many conflicting interests more quickly than a bankruptcy court would, and with a greater eye to what the effects are on the economy overall than just the issue of somehow being the referee between conflicting investment rights that have gone into the creating an investment that built up a particular institution.
If I can moderate, I'm not getting paid by the word, but let me ask a question. It's a very interesting proposition that somehow there should be a supervisory authority, a resolution authority that could somehow make allocations of economic interest in a way different from that set forth in the various contracts that created those interests. I find that to be fascinating. And I wonder, let me make a statement and have you react to it. The statement I'd like to make is this. When Congress passed the resolution authority for Fannie and Freddie in August or July, that resolution authority created such uncertainty as to how the rights of creditors would be treated if exercised that it, in fact, exacerbated the run that occurred on Fannie and Freddie that led to their failure in September. Do you have a reaction to that?
I think that's perfectly correct. It's Peter Wallison. I do think that that is one of the results that will come from a system of resolution in which the government is making the decisions. Because inevitably, when the government is making the decisions, there is a fight among various constituencies for advantage and priority. And the lenders would not necessarily come out on top in such a fight. So someone is going to lose and someone is going to win, but it is going to be highly political. That raises for me, too, John, one other point, or a couple of other points, really. One is, how do we pay for this? It seems to me the experience we have with regulators is always the same, and that is that they do not want failures to occur. So although we are thinking in terms of a mechanism that actually unwinds or liquidates these, quote, systemically important companies. In fact, what we will have in reality is a mechanism to keep these systemically important companies alive, just like has happened with Fannie and Freddie. As we know, although they are under government control, It is in a conservatorship rather than a receivership. And in a conservatorship, the purpose of a conservatorship is to return the organization to health. And I would see that that's exactly what will happen with any sort of system for resolving financial institutions other than banks, especially those that have initially been labeled as systemically significant. But even if Wayne, and I hope you're right, Wayne, even if Wayne is correct that that is not something that is written into policy so that we wait to see what is happening under the circumstances and kind of on an ad hoc basis we resolve these financial institutions, I think the result of that is going to be that there will be many, many more bailouts, introducing much more uncertainty and moral hazard into the financial sector. And we still haven't talked about how this is going to be paid for. Are we going to have taxpayers paying for it? Or are we going to have a system such as we have now in the banking area where the banks actually pay for it through their deposit insurance premiums?
Let me comment on the pay for it because I think that's a crucial point and I think it's an important governor on the process. I think using Fannie and Freddie as an example isn't as helpful in this particular setting as we might want because Fannie and Freddie are government-sponsored enterprises. They're chartered by Congress with specific authorities and their own regulator that deals with them. And their ability to fund themselves is created in the law as well. So they're kind of special animals, and because they've been given special privileges, whether you agree with those privileges or not, they've got them. You need a regulator in place to take the position of the marketplace that has been muted by the special privileges given to Fannie and Freddie. I would hope that what we're talking about are institutions where there might be a systemic problem with their going out of business immediately, but there wouldn't be if they were phased out. And I think the way you govern that and keep us from getting into a conservatorship situation, which I agree with Peter, if you establish a conservatorship, you can get in, but getting out of it's going to be very difficult. I'm not sure how you get out of the Fannie and Freddie conservatorship, and there's money there. I think the way you keep from getting into that is you don't provide any money for it. There's no pre-funding, nor is there any post-funding kind of situation. I think what we're talking about here is a means whereby you can wind them down as you would in a liquidation kind of bankruptcy and sell off the important assets, keep certain systemic functions operating until you can sell them off to somebody else. Take, for example, an important clearing function. You need to continue to have that clearing function, but there's value in that clearing function. You just need to find somebody who's willing to come forward, analyze it, and then put a price on it and buy it. That's why, in my view, the right party to do that is not one of these government agencies that's out there and has its own particular fiefdom that they're supposed to oversee, but rather that's really a function for the Treasury Secretary. And the Treasury Secretary would be given that authority, takes over the institution, and prepares to wind it down, getting funding either the way you do through the bankruptcy process or through the sale of discounted assets on that institution, as well as basically meeting out how much of the hits from that the failure of that institution will be borne by the investors, both shareholders and debt holders.
Wayne, I think you've made a good point. This is Peter Wallace, and I think you've made a good point about the how you keep it from being a bailout situation, and that is by not appropriating any money to begin with, and therefore they have to use the existing resources that are within the institution. What I don't think you have actually at least satisfied my concerns with is the idea that this is somehow going to be better than the bankruptcy system, because the idea of handing over to the Treasury Department an organization that has no particular skill in winding down entities, a failing financial institution of some kind, which might be a kind of financial institution that they know nothing about. That would be true, for example, of a large insurance company. They know absolutely nothing about insurance in the Treasury Department. Would actually mean that the winding down or the liquidation of that organization would take a lot longer than a bankruptcy would take, because the bankruptcy courts are familiar with the processes that you have to go through to wind down or liquidate a company. They know how to get all the various parties together to have them develop requests for their share of whatever is left, and they can do the compromise among the various parties, but of course the Treasury Department knows nothing about that. And in addition, of course, the Treasury, like any other political entity, will be under huge pressure to make sure that certain groups get everything and other groups have to pay the bill. So I don't think you're suggesting something that is ultimately going to be very fair.
Well, I think the political nature of the Treasury Department is what I see as attractive in it, because along with that political nature of it comes accountability. If they get it wrong, there is going to be accountability. That's one of the problems I have of giving this kind of authority to an agency like the Federal Reserve or to the FDIC. Very little accountability there. Maybe you don't mix politics in with it, but you also don't have any means of correcting bad action or bad policies, whereas you do have that kind of nexus with a Treasury Secretary. Now, the way I've seen this operate, and having worked at Treasury Department as you have, you understand what kind of an agency that is. Treasury is, I don't think most people realize, is really a very small entity if you don't count its various satellite entities like the IRS and the other different pieces. But what we call Main Treasury, the folks over on 1500 Pennsylvania Avenue, is not a very big agency. Where I have seen that as a real benefit is that forces Treasury to rely upon other people. And so the way I would envision this authority would work is, let's say it's an insurance company that's in difficulty. Treasury would say, XYZ insurance company chartered in the state of Massachusetts is in impending danger of bankruptcy, about to go bankrupt, or is indeed in that condition. It is really too much for the authorities in Massachusetts to handle in an organized way. Therefore, Treasury is stepping in to assist with the liquidation of that entity in an orderly way, drawing upon the assets of that institution, but relying upon the expertise of the people in the state of Massachusetts. And I think you do that with various other institutions. The securities firm, you rely upon the SEC to do the detail work, but Treasury comes in to manage that operation to make sure that what is being done preserves that systemically significant function or situation and takes all of those economy-wide concerns into account, which a bankruptcy judge is not required and probably unlikely to take into account.
I'm surprised, after all the experience you've had in government, I guess it's been different from mine, Wayne, it's Peter Wallison again,
uh-huh.
I'm surprised that you have so much faith in the political system, because what will happen is that just as we are watching now happen with the automobile companies, there will be tremendous pressures on the Treasury Department to do something different from what the Massachusetts authorities would do if they were winding it down, or a bankruptcy court would do, and that is to make sure that certain constituencies get more than others. Those results don't actually have any political consequences one way or the other. No one will be able to conclude afterward that it was good or bad. What will happen is that Congress will be importuned to put up more money for the purpose of making sure that the groups they want to see fully covered actually get the full coverage that they want to see happen. So even though we will not have anything appropriated for this purpose, I think the way the politics would work is that the money will be made available and the organization probably will ultimately be bailed out rather than liquidated. But even if it is liquidated, taxpayer funds will be made available to do it. The reason I think these organizations are unlikely to be liquidated is that if they are systemically significant or systemically important, it is for a reason. And it is not that their immediate collapse would have a problem, but that their departure from the scene in any way would have an impact somehow on the rest of the financial system. Now, as you know from my earlier remarks, I don't believe that's really true, but I do believe that the regulators, whether it's the Treasury Department or the Federal Reserve or anyone else, will make those statements, because it is always their concern that any kind of failure that causes a disruption in the market will redound into criticism of them. So I am very skeptical that we could ever have a process in which actually these large, systemically important companies are actually liquidated, I think the result will be the money will be found from Congress or elsewhere to bail them out.
I'm equally skeptical with regard to human nature and what people will do and the political process, but I don't think that insulating people from that process makes them necessarily wiser. That's why I don't favor giving any of this kind of authority to the regulators that are insulated from the political process. But similarly with regard to the bankruptcy process, I don't think that the bankruptcy judge, because he's the bankruptcy judge, is going to be a more infallible arbiter of the conditions of those institutions than if that authority is given to somebody who is subject to the disciplines of the political pressures. Now, there will be an ebb and flow, but there is, I think, take the example of the automakers. Whatever this Treasury Secretary is going to do, whatever this President is going to do, they're going to pay a political price for it if they get it wrong. And I think in many cases they may already be suffering political harm for getting it wrong. Is that a guarantee that they'll always get it right? No, but I think what it does is that it at least submits and subjects the errors to a disciplining process that is more immediate than would be in the case for a bankruptcy judge or for an insulated regulator.
I think the answer is that they will get it right for the ones who do well in the process, and they will get it wrong for the ones who don't do well. And what happens then is that Congress will step in order to help the constituency that isn't doing well and provide the funds so that the enterprise will be able to survive, and no one will be harmed. That's the thing that worries me more than anything else, is that any one of these special mechanisms for bailing out or for rescuing or bailing out institutions will always turn in, ultimately, to bailout propositions. That's
well,
the way the politics seem to work.
I think in our democracy you're not going to get away from that to some degree. Take a look at the automotive sector. There really was no kind of systemic risk supervisor or resolution authority in place. They really are subject to the bankruptcy process, but nevertheless Congress has gotten involved.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that you leave them bare to the bankruptcy process isn't going to keep Congress out. I think to the degree you have a credible program in place that can unwind these folks, I think to that extent you run at least something of a fighting chance that you can keep Congress out of the picture.
Well, I think we've come to about as much as we can say about this subject, John. So
I do want to ask both of you a question, though. Let's take AIG as an example of an institution, it's not a bank, but certainly deeply intertwined with the banking system and the securities world. What would you do differently? I mean, what we've done is thrown a bunch of money at it.
Mm-hmm.
But Peter, under your world, what would you do with AIG?
I think I would have sent them right to bankruptcy. I think the Fed panicked and should not have started down the road of trying to bail them out. My view, after looking at AIG, after its various problems arose, looking at their financial statements, it looks to me as though they are not such a, they never were such a serious problem. They had about $145 billion in borrowings, of which about $45 billion was due within a year. So, again, they were not one of these institutions that would have caused any major problem if they had defaulted, because there would have been losses, of course, but they would have developed over time. They wouldn't have been cash losses immediately. So one of the things that was said about AIG is that, well, it isn't really their losses, it's their credit default swaps. They have so many credit default swaps it would have caused chaos in the market. But in fact, that isn't true either, because a credit default swap, as you know, operates very much like, it's not insurance, but it operates like insurance, and that is it doesn't actually pay off until there is an actual loss. And so if your insurance company goes out of business before you have a fire in your home, what you have to do is go out and get another insurance company. And that is what the organizations that were protected by the credit default swaps that they had with AIG had to do. Now, it might well have been that they would have had to pay more, that is, in premiums, for their credit default swap protection after than they were actually paying to AIG. But most of them had collateral to cover themselves on that. And in fact, the largest of the institutions, no one knew this at the time of AIG's failure, but the largest of these institutions that had bought credit default swap protection from AIG was Goldman Sachs. And it had $12.9 billion, as I recall, of credit default swap protection. They said afterward, when asked, if they would have suffered a loss if AIG had been allowed to go into bankruptcy, they said no, it would have been negligible. And why? Well, because they had plenty of collateral from AIG before AIG went down, and they had also protected themselves against an AIG failure by buying credit default swaps from others. So I'm not convinced at all that an AIG should have been kept from failure. And in fact, it's a really good example from my perspective of what will happen when a large institution is in trouble and the government gets involved, because the first thing the government is going to do is going to try to bail it out so that trouble does not spread anywhere else in the government's view. And so if we have a mechanism in place for institutions like AIG to be bailed out, they will be bailed out, just like the Fed did at this time, whether or not funds have actually been appropriated. And, of course, in the AIG case, there were no appropriated funds, just a demand on the part of the government for Congress to provide the funds, or the Federal Reserve steps in, as it did in the case of AIG, and provided funds that Congress hadn't even had to appropriate.
This is Wayne Abernathy here speaking. I think the AIG case tends to make the point that I've been trying to make, which is you need to have a credible resolution program in place so that if the government steps in, you know they are stepping in order to wind down the company, not to keep it going. And that at the end of the day, that company that they stepped in to deal with is going to cease to exist. It is the government is stepping in order to wind it down, sell off its pieces, preserve stability and order in the financial marketplace. I think it's very difficult to make the case that what has happened with AIG has in any way been the right thing to do. I think when everything is said and done, as Peter points out, the amount of money the government's put in will exceed the amount of money that was really at risk in the first place. But by keeping that institution, which was in essence insolvent or unable to continue its operations, going on, you've perpetuated the problem and expanded it, while at the same time removing a lot of market discipline that I think is very important. And I think, frankly, at the time was a very important piece of helping to feed the panic. I'm not sure that we really got into full panic mode until those series of actions that were taken by the Treasury Department late summer, early fall of last year. But those were all done without a systemic resolution process in place. I think it makes the case of why you need to have one, why it needs to be credible, and so that when the government steps in, you know what they're doing. They're going in there, and they're winding down that operation.
Well, it's funny how the same example can serve both of our views. This is Peter Wallison, because as I look at AIG, what the Fed did with AIG is exactly what the Treasury Department would do if it could. The only difference is the Treasury Department doesn't actually have the money, and what you are saying is that the Treasury Department will then close them down if they don't have the money. My view is they will then go to Congress. They will say that it's necessary to have this money. We have this process in place so that we can either rescue or we can liquidate companies. That's what this whole process has been created for. It's our judgment that in this case we have to rescue this company, which is what the Fed has done with AIG, and they'll get the money from Congress. So
how do you think that will work, though?
Either way, it looks bad. I'm sorry?
How do you think that would work, though, if rescue were off the table? In other words, if the statute said, Treasury, you may exercise this authority for the orderly resolution, but not the rescue of the entity.
Okay. Well, in that case, yes, it would be completely different if the statute said that, but that is not what the administration is proposing.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And that's right. What we began with was the idea the administration is proposing a system that would that would permit rescue. But yeah, if the statute said under no circumstances can this process be used to keep a company alive, given the fact that these things can be, the language is never tough enough to keep Congress from doing whatever the heck it wants, that would be a lot better. But in that case, I don't see why we even need any language, because we don't actually have anything in place to do it. All we're saying is we're creating some sort of ad hoc process that if we ever have to take over one of these institutions, it will be wound down.
Well, my view is to take the ad hoc out of it, make it clear what the procedures are and what the conditions are, how the secretary invokes it, but that it's not ad hoc. I think the ad hoc is what created a whole lot of additional risks, because people wondered, well, what are the rules? Why are these guys, what are they doing, and under what authorities are they doing it?
Well, isn't this just some specialized bankruptcy court then with input from Treasury to make sure they don't do something really stupid?
I think that's right, that is authorized in addition to what they do with regard to arbitrating the various rights of the investors and the creditors, but also taking into account, as we're resolving this institution, what the systemic impact and consequences might be.
If you are really talking about systemic impact, then you are talking about the possibility of bailing them out rather than winding them down. Because the whole issue associated with systemic risk is that if one of these institutions actually fails, if actually goes out of business, then it's going to have a worldwide or even a nationwide systemic effect. Now, I don't believe that, but that is the ideology that is underlying this, and once you establish that, then I don't think it's possible to say the only thing that we will be able to do with these institutions is liquidate them.
Well, I agree with that, too. I'm not sure I could identify for you. In fact, I'm pretty confident I can't. An institution that could not, but for which their existence, the economy would go into the tank. I think what I'm really focusing on is where you have the problem coming from the abrupt discontinuance of a particular function until others can come in and serve that function. And again, I'll go back to clearance as an example. We have, for various economic reasons, concentrated clearance in this country in a few institutions. That clearance function has to go forward. It has to continue for a lot of other institutions in order to do what they're doing. But that clearance function doesn't have to take place in XYZ company. If XYZ company fails, that function can be, in a fairly orderly way, transferred to somebody else who'd be willing to take up that function, but probably couldn't be done overnight.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't disagree with the clearance function. I think that there are banks, if we're talking about Mellon, New York Bank and Mellon, that is one of the major clearing institutions, and if that bank had some sort of trouble, the clearing function would be substantially impeded. But that isn't something we have to set up an entire system for, because that is a bank, and we have all of the resources of the banking industry available to take care of that, or the FDIC and the Fed to take care of that kind of problem. If we had a private clearinghouse for something like credit default swaps, which is one of the ideas that is being pushed here in Washington, or maybe for futures or something like that, and if that clearing system broke down, there would possibly be a necessity for the government to step in and do something. But that can all be done ad hoc. You don't have to have a process set up for something like that, and I don't think Congress or anyone else is prepared to make laws now about how things would be exactly done when we don't know how the problem will actually arise. There will always be language in such a statute that says under extreme and exigent circumstances you can do something else, which is the basis on which the Fed took its discount window authority and bailed out AIG.
Well, there are a variety of other clearing functions besides Bank of New York Mellon. There are several in the securities area, several in the futures area, and outside of the. I think that the real challenge, though, is predicting what will be the next source of systemic shock.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I could do that. I'm not sure I would want to. identify any regulator to have that kind of foresight, because I think four times out of five they're going to get it wrong, and if they get it right, there's going to be a lot of mere coincidence involved in doing that. But on the other hand, I think you need to have authorities that are clear so that when they do act, we know what they're doing and what authorities they're proceeding under and what the rules of the game are, so that everybody else can continue on with their business.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. I think, Wayne and Peter, I think this has been terrific. And I don't know if any of you have any last thoughts, but I will open a minute or two for you to wrap up.
Well, let me just say that I am, as a last thought, quite worried about the support that I see in Washington for the proposals that the administration has advanced. It doesn't seem to me that everyone outside Washington understands how important these things are and what effect they will have on the structure of the financial sector in the United States. These are highly significant changes which can have a major impact on all of us, and yet I see very little attention being paid to it other than in the precincts of the few groups in Washington who pay attention to these things. So I'd like to get more information out about it. I'd like to make people aware that we are looking at something that will change in substantial ways our financial sector, and I hope this podcast will have that effect.
I think we hear frequently that there is a consensus around the need for a systemic risk regulator, consensus for where it ought to go. People mention the Fed or whatever. I think just because there may appear to be a consensus, that doesn't mean that the issue has been fully thought through or thought out. And I think Peter correctly points out there are some very serious consequences that can flow from getting this wrong. First of all, if you come up with a program that identifies institutions ahead of time as being systemically significant, and I think if there is systemic risk, it's more likely to come from instruments or practices than it is from an institution, unless you actually go and create your problem by identifying institutions as being systemically significant, because by doing so, you will make them systemically significant because of the market advantages you will give to them. And then the second source, I think, of real serious problems would be who you give this duty to. If you decide you want to create this responsibility and give it to the Federal Reserve, who else is going to take care of monetary policy? And will this become the most significant job in the mind of the Federal Reserve? Will it corrupt their monetary policy function? I think there are some that would say that the Federal Reserve's already been willing to court inflation more than they should because of this additional resolution role that they've been playing over the past year. Giving it to the FDIC, do we run the risk of distracting the FDIC from its specific narrow function with regard to deposits? I think there are all sorts of ways that we can create far more damage, far more problems than we would solve by anything that's being contemplated.
Terrific. Thanks to both of you, and with that, we'll conclude our podcast.
Thank you very much, John, for excellent work.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Peter.
And thanks for inviting us, Federalist Society. It's been fun. I've learned a lot from my colleague, Wayne.
Thank you, Pete.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federal Society multimedia, please visit our website at federalsociety.org/multimedia.